Hi, this is Ken McCarthy from Jazz on the Tube, and today we have a call with one of our friends from New Orleans. We're recording this on February 1st, which, of course, is the first day of African American History Month. I like to think that every month at Jazz on the Tube is African American History Month, but it's good to focus on it for the month of February. This guest and I met over the topic of Cuba, and then I got to learn about some of the fascinating work he's doing in New Orleans. And I'd like to welcome him now. It's Al Jackson. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Good morning, and thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Al, could you tell us a little bit about your New Orleans background? Are you a native son? Are you someone that moved there from another place? What's your connection to the city?
I am a native son, born in the heart of Treme, which is the place where music, in fact, was born. All sorts of music. Attended local schools in this particular Treme area. Started off on a clarinet, as most young boys, but left it alone. Unfortunately, I regret it today. But I've been here 73 years and giving something back that I've acquired through my world travels.
Wow. We've talked a lot. I never would have guessed you were 73 in a million years. I was guessing like 50. So you're born in Treme, and a lot of people have seen, I hope, at least some of the Treme series that was on HBO, which I think was pretty well done, you know, as TV goes. Can you tell our listeners why is the Treme neighborhood so important to not only jazz history, but music history and even civil rights history?
Well, it's simple, and one needs to think back historically. When the French came out of Creole Mobile, today Alabama, into New Orleans a few years later, 1718, thereabouts, the original city was what is now known as the French Quarter of Vieux Carré, the Old Square. Rampart Street, Ramparts, as a military speaking, divides the landmass on the north side of the French Quarter from the French Quarter. Enslaved Africans, by and large, and free people of color and other immigrants who are not as affluent live on the north side of the French Quarter, which is where everything happened and became known as Treme, named after a fellow who came in from France, who's a hat maker, married a nice young lady whose father gave them several parcels of land. And when the city decided to name a subdivision, it took on his name, Faubourg Treme. But Treme is where all the old heads who really brought life to the music we call jazz today, in fact, were born and performed as well.
So it was a really important cultural center for the city of Fountainhead.
It was a very, very uptown for the city. And there was no uptown at that time as well. Canal Street was a canal, 1700, 1800.
Mm.
Yeah.
Wow.
Everything happened here, and it came out of Treme. By and large, it came out of Treme.
And Treme also has a civil rights history too, doesn't it?
It does. That particular part of the history, one can find couched in historic St. James African Methodist Episcopal Church in later years. But early on, one of our premier classical musicians in 1861 staged a sit-in demonstration at the St. Charles Theater. He was a composer, arranger, and pianist, graduated from the Paris Conservatory, and decided the night he was off from performing in the orchestra that he would become a client, a participant, and listen to the music of the opera.
Mm-hmm.
And was escorted out manually by the police. Irate, light-skinned Negro, refused to move.
That was the headline? Wow.
Yeah. So before Treme and the history of our civil rights movement as well.
Well, one of the things that I stumbled on, literally, because I wasn't planning on it, finding it, was when I visited New Orleans last month, there was a one-day conference at the old Mint on the Dewdrop Inn, which is in a different neighborhood. But it's amazing, all the way into the 40s and 50s, and I guess maybe even later, those same laws that were in effect in the 19th century were in effect still in New Orleans. In fact, one of the interesting stories about the Dewdrop Inn is that the owner got so sick of the police harassment, because I guess there was a law that prohibited white and black New Orleanians from enjoying entertainment together in the same room. And from what I understood from the from what I was told at the conference, that to do it legally, you had to hang a sheet. It's unbelievable. Down the middle of the room. And the owner said, you know what, we're not going to do it. And very often they were raided, the patrons, and were taken away, black and white. Finally, he just sued the city and got them to stop. So, you know, for younger listeners or people that don't have a historical background in this, that's what was going on in New Orleans and throughout the South. Now, you're developing, another important cultural institution in New Orleans called the Tremé's Petit Jazz Museum. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. And, of course, Ken, has been a labor of love, and as I mentioned early on, it's an opportunity for me to give something back to my neighborhood, but the Tremé Petit Jazz Museum is unlike the museum at the Mint, and I'm not attempting to diminish any of the qualities of the Mint. What they've got is great, and everyone should see it. Where we differ is that what I do, or what we do, myself and my board, we tell a story of how jazz started. And the catchphrase is, do you think jazz dropped out of the sky? Of course it did. So we take folks back to that entire Sierra Leone, to Angola region, Senegambia, the entire West Coast, the Calabar River area, bringing all of those sounds and nuances into the mix, into slavery, into the Door of No Return, into Toussaint Louverture, who defeated Napoleon's army to establish Haiti, and the results of the people therefrom brought in another 5,000-6,000 free people of color who had already been trained classically in French music and culture, and combining that with the essence of Africa, it came to New Orleans, and somebody went to Cuba first, and that piece as well accompanied the visits on the immigration pattern. So in Congo Square, we find a triumph of Spanish, French, and African music. And from that point on, it began to take a form of its own and ultimately became ragtime with Jelly Roll. And Buddy Bolden added his uptown gospel influences and retweaked all of this. And we then called it trad jazz. And, of course, from trad jazz are the guys from New Orleans move about the country and the world. The improvisation became greater into another, not another, but a better, a more modern art form. And today we know it as jazz.
It's amazing our historical disconnects. You know, I'm thinking of another one, also Louisiana-based. You know, as you know, there are French speakers throughout Louisiana, the Cajuns, and of course people speaking French Creole still. Fats Domino grew up in a house where he learned French Creole before he learned English.
Absolutely. That was the lingua franca of the slave owners, French and Spanish.
Yeah. And people, you know, people are aware of the French Quarter, and if they actually go to New Orleans, they'll see these plaques that indicate that the streets in the Quarter had Spanish names for a while when the Spanish were running it. But people don't understand the significance of that. And when I think about that, I also think about the situation of the Cajuns, where the Cajuns were told, oh, that French that you speak, that's really garbage French. Nobody in France would understand you. They were told that for decades. And then when World War II came along, and a lot of them ended up over in France, they discovered they could speak fine. You know, there were some changes in accents and maybe slight changes in vocabulary, but they could understand each other perfectly. And I see that as analogous to the situation with jazz. We get this, we're told this vague thing that jazz has some African roots, and then that's it. Just sort of drop it. And your museum is saying, no, we want to get into this. We want to look at this with a lot of precision and tell the whole story. You know, I love that. Jazz just didn't fall out of the sky.
Yeah, and that's real. One of the instruments that has been completely taken away from African culture is the banjo.
Hmm.
Or is it to West Africa?
I know Bela Fleck, the great banjo virtuoso, did something good on that. He went to Africa and found he found all these guys that were playing similar instruments, and he was able to jam with them right off.
Yes. But it shows also that music is really for everybody, Ken.
Mm-hmm.
There should be no barriers, period, when we speak. I mean, there shouldn't be a barrier at all, but when we're speaking of music, Music's for everybody. We're all one people, one music, man. It should be enjoyed as such.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because I just discovered this great resource within the world of Cuban music named Tony Basanta, B-A-S-A-N-T-A. And it's a long story, but he really knows what's going on in the Cuban jazz scene. He's Cuban-born. He lives in Vermont now. But he had this quote that he requoted from a friend, and his friend was Juan Antonio Leyva, and his friend told him, "We can bring a Chinese, a Romanian, a Greek, and an Alaskan man, and they start playing, and they do not have to speak the same language. They can be playing for 10 days without saying a word, but they are communicating."
Exactly.
And that reminds me also of my late friend Ornette Coleman, who always talked about music as a language. In fact, he had this dream of doing a symphony with a each seat would be occupied by someone from a different country playing their own indigenous instrument, and the composition was going to be called The Oldest Language. It may be the oldest language, you know, maybe before we figured out how to use our vocal cords with the precision that we use today, maybe we sang and whistled and drummed and got our message across that way. Who knows?
Who knows? And it's very plausible.
Well, tell us about the physicality of the museum. How does it exist, and where can people see it?
Well, we're located at 1500 Governor Nichols Street, and we're also on Facebook. You can Google us, Tremaise, with an S without the accent, Petit, P-E-T-I-T, Jazz Museum. We'd love folks to go and visit the website. There are a few pictures up there now. We're working on adding some more to it. The best thing to do is to plan a Jazz Fest trip to New Orleans and add us to your bucket list. Come by and visit, and also give us a call at 504-715-0332. And for the persons who call early enough, we do offer a bed and breakfast unit as a part of the museum.
Oh.
Yeah. So we do have a nice suite with a sitting room with some images of the musicians around the wall. So keep you musically inclined and in mind, and just walk downstairs and have a cup of coffee or a bagel, or a croissant inside of the museum.
Wow. I've got to think that's an ideal way to visit New Orleans, for whether somebody's been there a lot or hasn't been there yet. So Governor Nichols is the street that runs from the quarter across Rampart into Treme. How far? On your Claiborne.
South of Claiborne. And we're two blocks from Claiborne, four blocks from Rampart, about a quarter, and one block from Esplanade. We're located across the street from the African-American Museum of Art and Culture, which is now closed for renovation, so we're hopefully picking up that slack.
Great. Well, for those of you that haven't visited New Orleans, that's a really sweet spot in the city. And talk about regrets. I was offered a really good deal on a house back in 06 on Governor Nichols, just north of Rampart, and I didn't do it. But that's a whole other story. Wow, so somebody could call you and say, "Hey, Al, we're coming to New Orleans. We want to be there 3 days," and then you could fix them up with the suite. They could start their tour, which, you know what, really would be the ideal place to start a tour in New Orleans. And then I would say go to Congo Square right after, and then you're really going to be in the heart and soul of what New Orleans is all about, and then you could take it from there. Now, I haven't had a chance to visit the museum myself yet. So it's in a building. It's several rooms. What kind of things would people see?
Well, it's encountered in one of the older buildings. Kind of the building itself would sort of remind you of Delmonico's in New York. It's kind of a flat iron building.
Oh, really? Cool.
Yeah. Two story. Right now, everything has been concentrated to the first floor, and we've got about 40-45. Images around the wall, which in a chronological order from 1768 until 1968. And we chose 1968 because we have an image of a 1968 Jazz Fest poster.
Ah.
Louis Armstrong's first and last Jazz Fest.
Wow. Well, wow.
Love Randy Lewis and Duke Ellington and Pete Fountain and Jerry Mulligan and Dave Brubeck, and the seats were $5, $4, and $3.
That was a long time ago.
That was a long time ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
And now, why 1768? Why did you use that as the starting date?
Well, that was a very hotbed period of time when transatlantic slave trade was really flourishing before folk, England started to like, okay, this is inhumane, stop it. So what we've done, we chose that day to take it from West Africa into the Caribbean and to a slave ship to show the anguish. But at that point in time, what we do is we use it as a juncture to play the djembe drum and tell the visitors that despite the agony and the stress, they did not forget how to play the drum, which is the backbeat of New Orleans music today. Drumming is.
Yeah, in New Orleans produces drummers to a degree that's almost unbelievable. I mean, if you just do the math and figure out, well, how many people live in New Orleans and how many, you know, musicians are there in New Orleans, then you count the number of world-class drummers that have come out of that city, you know. And of course, one of the greats, a lot of people may not know his name, but you've heard his music on hundreds of albums, is the great Earl Palmer. And maybe it's worth telling the story briefly. He was the studio jazz drum, studio drummer for all the early rock and roll records that came out of L.A. I mean, Beach Boys and, you know, all these things. It wasn't the Beach Boys back there playing the drums. It was Earl Palmer, and he's a product of that incredible drum culture. And of course, it makes sense that New Orleans would have the ultimate drum culture in the city, in the country, because of its history.
Exactly. It's combined Spanish through Cuba and French through Saint Domingue, Haiti, and via West Africa, it came here and manifests itself right here in Treme, Congo Square, and the streets of Treme.
When a lot of people hear about, you know, the French Quarter or, you know, the French roots of New Orleans, you know, again, it's one of those vague things. It's not really explained. What they really should be talking is about the French Creole origins of New Orleans, and they really, to be very precise, should be talking about the Haitian origins of New Orleans culture. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. In 1803, after the revolution had ended and Haiti gained its freedom, many of the Haitians became immigrants to New Orleans. Those who didn't go to Jamaica or to Cuba, about 5,000 came to New Orleans and brought a lot of music with them. One of them in particular, Edmond Bidet's father, was Toussaint Louverture's band leader, who decided not to remain in Haiti at that time after the revolution had ended, instead migrated to New Orleans.
Oh, really?
His son Edmond Bidet, of course, was taught the clarinet by his father and switched to the violin. And later on in life, he traveled to Paris as a free man of color and studied at the Paris Conservatory and became the symphony conductor in Paris and Bordeaux until 1903.
Wow.
And the good thing about that, the important thing, Ken, about that is enslaved Africans were not allowed to read nor write. So it was the Afro-Creole from either Haiti or Cuba who came to New Orleans, and they were literate, the ones who kept the written music alive and composed and these multiplicity of songs. Of course, many of those songs had the roots. The backbeat, of course, was Africanness, but also in polka, waltz, and mazurkas. These guys were trained in Paris, in the Paris Conservatory, but having the knowledge to read, they were able to teach the younger guys how to read music, and music theory. That kept it going.
I think something that music fans may not be aware of is the super high level of musicianship that came from the islands, from Haiti, as you just described, but also from Cuba. And I know when, I think it was Captain Reese, I forget his first name, but the orchestra leader who basically brought jazz to Europe for the first time during World War One. I know that when he was putting his band together, he passed through Puerto Rico to pick up his reed section because they were just so good. So jazz was brought to Europe for the first time in a big way, and the band was filled with guys from the island of Puerto Rico. You know, so that's another example of just the high quality of musicianship. You know, I'm wondering if even instruments like the clarinet came to New Orleans for the first time in the hands of French Creoles. Because people don't realize, I think, what a rough place New Orleans was in the very early days. It didn't have much culture.
Well, it did. The clarinet was part of the French musical instrument repertoire. And if we reflect back on 1797, for example, the first opera in the world was held in Havana, La Habana, and it was Guitry by Sylvain. And even there, the pit musicians were Creoles of Afro-Spanish origin. And to some degree, there's a lot of French influence still today. And we'll talk about that later on in Cuba. It left Cuba and came to New Orleans to the opera house, Theatre d'Orléans, here in New Orleans. And again, the pit musicians were Afro-Creoles who had that combined culture.
Yeah, that very, very super high level of musical training. Could read, new theory, excellent performers, the whole package. And that was pretty unusual anywhere in North America because, again, the whole country was kind of, it was a frontierish, rough kind of place, and there wasn't a lot of time and space for that kind of musical training. So that sudden influx of well-trained artists from the French Creole world had a big, big impact on New Orleans and then later on the whole U.S. Hey, speaking of Cuba, I know that you just got back relatively recently from your first trip there. And, for all of us, United States citizens, this is an amazing time where, at least for now, we can just get on a plane and go and see this island that's been cut off from us for over 55 years. So can you tell us a little bit about your trip, kind of places you went and discoveries you made and insights you had?
Once we landed at Jose Martí's airport, that was phase one. I said, oh, my God, why? My older daughter and I, the family went down. We felt so much as though we were at home. I must admit that historically, ancestrally, we do have a great, great, great grandfather, Jose Bermudez, who in fact came from Cuba.
Uh-huh.
Just as on the other side, we have a great, great, great grandmother who came from Saint-Domingue.
Saint-Domingue being in the old name for Haiti. Wow.
Yeah, for Haiti. And I've been to Haiti as well, but I felt more at home in La Habana than I did with my first trip to Haiti at Saint-Domingue. But as I walked the streets of the old square at Plaza Vieja, I saw myself being in New Orleans again at our Jackson Square, which at that time was known as Plaza de Armas. And I'm saying, remove the statue, replace the cobblestones in the street. And we were looking at our sister city. The people, I look at the people, and I'm looking at New Orleanians, this Afro, French, Spanish, Native American, Creole look. It was just fantastic. The music, of course, was very much familiar with. I'm just at a ball, and it brought back for me so many memories. You mentioned how long Cuba had been cut off. And I lived in Germany, for example, during the 60s. And one of the fellows I met was Roberto Blanco, who was a conguero from La Habana, actually from Santiago. And it was just ironic. A lady who came to visit the museum 6 months ago from Wiesbaden, Germany, I asked her, said, have you ever heard of a guy named Roberto Blanco? She said, yep, he's still in Wiesbaden.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't believe it. He's still there. He was part of my whole conguero Cuban inspiration that gave me that raison d'etre when I lived there. I got to go to Cuba. And lo and behold, the opportunity presented itself. And we had a ball. Now, interestingly, one of the first restaurants we dined, the name was Union Française, the French Union, the French club.
Okay. In Havana.
Yeah.
Oh, was it good?
It was great, yeah. My further discovery was the Cienfuegos, which was founded by Louisianians. So I've got to go back to complete this discovery. There's so much in Cuba that we, in fact, have in common here in New Orleans that has not been discussed. And, of course, the music is very inclusive. We've had Afro-Cuban music in Treme that I know of since the middle 50s, early 60s. Especially when those folks were about to initially leave the island, many came not only to Miami, but also to New Orleans. I remember Yeri Shiochina mentioned La Habana, Cuba, and several places around Chimay, and we knew we would go there, and the Sima would come in, the lady would come in, and we would pachanga and charanga. There was no salsa back then, but then we dance. It was just a great time being there and reliving it all over again.
Let me make sure I understand. So there was charanga in New Orleans?
New Orleans, yeah. We danced pachanga, charanga.
Wow. And this was back when you, back in the 50s and 60s?
Late 60s.
No kidding.
It was 60s, yeah. When I came home from Europe, I danced pachanga, charanga in Europe.
In Europe?
Yeah, but when I came home, I found it as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm sorry? Oh, you know, I'm reminded that Dave Bartholomew, you know, the great, great musician and producer and worked with Transdomino and so many others, he said that he got the famous line. This line is so famous, this bass line is so famous that we think it fell from the sky, but it actually started with him, at least in the United States. But he says he got that bass line from a Cuban record. So this is great. This confirms that there was Cuban music in New Orleans. See, we don't know this. We don't know these things. So this kind of memory is so important. You know that line that goes dun 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 dun. That's Cuban. That's from Cuba.
Yeah.
And when I learned that, I felt
that's David's song. Yeah.
Yeah, I fell out of my chair when I heard that. And I mean, there's without that bass line, there's no rock and roll. And that it came from a Cuban record that Dave Bartholomew adapted is just amazing to me.
Well, so we can take Cuban music a bit further back. If we go back in time to 1898,
mm-hmm.
Spanish-American War,
mm-hmm.
The Excelsior and Auburn Brass Band members volunteered to go to Cuba and Puerto Rico to liberate those islands.
Really?
Yeah. And those musicians, especially, and I'll use one as an example because it'll give you a good appreciation of what Treme has brought to the table collectively. William McNeil was a chief musician for the 9th Immune Voluntary Band, who soldiers there. Of course, if you're a learned musician, you can, once you hear something, you know what the notes are. So
sure.
A lot of Cuban influences came back with them at the turn of the century.
Uh-huh.
You fast forward with William McNeil, and he then relocates from Treme to Chicago.
Uh-huh.
He then leaves Chicago and moves to rural Wisconsin and becomes white, no longer Creole.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Then his daughter marries Cab Calloway.
Oh, no way. Wow. My head's spinning on that. I'm trying to put it all together.
Wow. His daughter marries Cab Calloway. And then it's discovered when the passport becomes a requirement. We're not white. We're colored. But that's the connectivity of music to people.
Sure.
You know, and the McNeils just won the Cusos. They brought Cuban licks back to New Orleans.
Makes sense. It makes sense. And that was, you know, that unfortunately that period wasn't recorded, but as soon as recording started, you know, suddenly there's this different element. Well, of course, Jelly Roll Morton always talked about the Spanish tinge, and if you don't have Spanish tinge in your music, it isn't jazz. I mean, he couldn't have been more clear. He might have been a little more clear if he said the Cuban tinge, because that was probably the influence he was talking about. But
it was. He was speaking of that.
Yeah.
I used to tell folks when they would say, man, this is Spanish music. Excuse me? Have you ever seen a conga with a flamenco dancer? What are you talking about? You better go back. Oh, man, come to the Caribbean. It's been all this.
Right. I mean, there were so many immigrants in New Orleans, and there certainly were Spanish immigrants, you know, people from Spain, people from the Canary Islands. But when you're talking about the cultural input, overwhelmingly, it's the Caribbean. And I noticed that some of the younger musicians are getting hip to that. One of my favorite New Orleans-based musicians now is Aurora Nealon. And whenever her band, she plays in a band called the Panorama Jazz Band, I guess it's called, and then hers is Royal Roses. They're always putting in stuff for Martinique and, you know, things with a Latin roll to it, and I think that's a really good direction. And they alternate between trad jazz, and then they'll go into something, you know, from the Caribbean, and then back and forth and back and forth. And like you were saying earlier, you realize there really are no boundaries here. Those boundaries are just in our mind.
Our mind, yeah.
Yeah. So now, I wrote something down here that you said, and I just wanted to follow up on it. Cienfuegos, which is a city in Cuba. Did you say that was founded by New Orleanians?
Louisianians,
wow.
Yeah.
That is amazing. Cuba, as I figured out once I got there, and I'm sure you figured out, is huge.
Much to my surprise, is you've got to spend more than a week down there to really get a really good appreciation of that island. It's much more than I anticipated.
Well, I was lucky that the first time I went, and that was back in March, I went with Ned Sublett, who's written about New Orleans, and he also has written a very good book on the history of Cuban music. And he took us on I would call it a blitzkrieg. I mean, we were in the bus half the day, every day for 10 days, going from one village to another. We probably spent 4 days in Havana, and then the rest of the time in the western part of the island, going to littler places. And there was music everywhere. And we didn't even, you know, even with the 10 days and with him taking us by the hand, you know, with a all prepared itinerary, I realized we didn't scratch the surface. Not his fault. I think it would take 100 days to scratch this. Because we haven't even talked, I don't think neither you or I have been to the eastern part. Did you manage to get to Santiago or were you just in Havana?
No, that's my July trip to the Carnival.
Oh, the Carnival. Oh, my goodness.
I'm going to go back in July for the Carnival and do some more research on the... there were 12 men who deserted. A few were from New Orleans and trying to find their descendants. And see, there's still a music connection between those descendants and their great-grandfathers who came from New Orleans as musicians and migrated those too. And
really?
Kind of brought that to them, to Santiago.
Wow.
There's so much that has to be explored, man. It's like, oh, my God.
Yeah. And if anybody hasn't seen it on YouTube, there's a lot of video of the Carnival in Santiago. And but you're unless you've seen it, you can't even imagine it. And I can't even describe the intensity and the energy and the vitality of it. And then, of course, when you see that... And you just immediately think of New Orleans. Of course, it's a different energy, different look, but that idea of parading, of everybody out together in the street and marching around and playing music, and it's amazing. So you're going, wow, I've thought of trying to get there and seeing that in person, because that's got to be an amazing experience.
I think it might rival Rio's Carnival on the island.
Yeah, I think what's neat is that, you know, the parades in New Orleans and in Brazil, you know, they still have the same intent and energy, but they're polished, you know, they're modernized. But in Santiago de Cuba, it's a lot closer to the origin, to the original spirit of the thing. At least that's my take from looking at the videos.
I have a picture of a group of men and a few women. I have it in the museum, and I tend to show it to folk and ask them to kind of describe to me what their first thoughts might be. And of course, folk, oh yeah, I was at this club or that club, and that guy looks familiar. He's playing the box, and it's called a cajon. And
mm-hmm.
To look at his shoes, a wingtip with mesh. He said, oh yeah, we wear those shoes at our parade. Said, but that's Santiago de Cuba.
That's amazing. Oh my God. One of the things that struck me is just the regular folks that were just, you know, they'd come out of their houses and watch, and they would dance along. And these are some of the best. These are just regular people. They're not professionals. They're not trained. They're not, you know, they're not dancing every night professionally. They didn't go to the... And these are some of the best. This is some of the best dancing I've ever seen in my life. And this is just random folks just stepping out of their house, watching the parade go by, and, you know, dancing along with it as it goes by. A really rich culture. So I'm taking note that you're going to be there in July. That may give me courage to try it, because it's my understanding is it's hot in Cuba in July.
In New Orleans as well.
You're prepared. You're prepared.
The difference is Cuba has a sea in cool
air. Okay. That does make a difference. It does make a big difference. Hey, let's talk a little bit about the museum again. So when did you start it?
The museum itself, let me kind of give you a little background.
Okay.
I tell folk this is a 20-year overnight success. In 1997, myself and another fellow bought a building in Treme, which used to house the Negro Musicians Union. Of course, after the 65 Civil Rights Act passed and ultimately in 1968, the courts mandated that the two unions cease to be separate, but in fact merge. Part of the merge agreement was in that the white union had constructed a new building with central and a rehearsal room, that it was wise to abandon the frame structure which housed the Negro Musicians Union, and they did.
Mm-hmm.
Administratively, they took the critical papers, as in the union card information, the birth date, da-da-da-da-da, but a lot of the contractual performance contracts, images, were left inside of the building.
Uh-huh.
We bought the building almost 20 years later. We went into the building and cleaned the place up. Have you met Nina Buck? She owns the
Palm Cafe. I know her name, but I haven't met her.
So Nina owns the Palm Cafe. A little plug for Nina in the quarters. They still get original music down there from her. And actually, her piano player, Lars Edgren, was the second European to join the Negro Musicians Union. Barry Morton was the first. Lars is a pianist, and Barry is a drummer. Yeah, very interesting. They opted in 1961 and 68, respectively, to join the Negro Musicians Union, and told the folk in 174, which is the white union, you guys just leave us alone and play what you're playing. We wouldn't want to be to learn real music. But I said, hey, folks, I just picked up a contract with Louis Armstrong's name on it. I don't know what's on these floors, but do me a favor. Just collect everything, put them in these garbage bags, and we're just going to cart them off. But I've got a 1941 bylaws constitution book from the union to give each one of you guys as a souvenir. And it was fine. It was done. And after Katrina, when we didn't flood, I said, there was a reason. I went back to my warehouse and pulled all the bags out and began to go through it, and that's Ray Charles, 1950. It was James Brown with Herman Parker's band before he became James Brown and the Flames on his own. It was B.B. King and Jackie Wilson and, oh man, Ella and Lewis and Billie Holiday with Bumps Blackwell, who found Quincy Jones and Ray Charles and Seattle, Washington. It's like, oh my God, what a treasure trove here.
Wow.
And at which time I said, we need to find a home for this information. People need to know about this, because we can add the story of the evolution and bring it into what most folk know today. Folk can go back to Jairo, and then they're stuck.
Mm-hmm.
We bring them from West Africa through the Caribbean up to Jairo. We also include a fellow by the name of Lorenzo Tio, T-I-O. Lorenzo Tio and his brother, they were born in Veracruz, Mexico.
Mm.
When the dad died, who was a Spaniard from Barcelona, the mom brought the kids back to New Orleans. But Lorenzo Tio was a fellow who taught Sidney Bechet how to play saxophone.
Okay. Yeah.
So we have a small museum. We don't have the money that the other folk have, but we have a powerful story to tell folk if they really want to understand and listen.
Well, that's great, and I do encourage every jazz fan, you know, you really have to go to New Orleans. If you haven't been to New Orleans, you've missed something really important. And a lot of people, you know, like travelers everywhere, maybe have been to New Orleans once, and it's such a rich place, and it doesn't necessarily give up its riches immediately. You know, it's very easy to get distracted by, you know, the touristic kind of thing and miss the depth. So you might have been in New Orleans at some point, and I'm going to encourage you to go back and take a deeper look. And I can't imagine a better way to do it than staying at your place. I mean, that really should be the first stop. So if you would be so kind as to give your phone number again, and the address and any other information on how people can get in touch with you about either visiting or visiting and staying.
Super. That would be great. The phone number is area code 504-715-0382. The municipal address is 1500 Governor Nichols Street, New Orleans, Louisiana. You can find us on through internet access at TremaisBettineJazzMuseum.com. Take a look at some of our images and please come down and visit. We'd love to have you. Share the information
great.
With
great. And that's the T-P-E-T-I-T, the French word for small.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well,
Petite would work too well. Petite has a certain je ne sais quoi to it. But
it's true.
I love this and I really appreciate it. I would be remiss if I wouldn't to remind the folk of one of our pianists who is now on the big screen as in national television. And his name is Harry Connick Jr.
Mm-hmm.
One of his instructors was Ellis Marsalis,
mm-hmm.
the father of Quentin and Delfeo and Jason.
Yep. I mean, that's a whole other topic, but it's worth saying that, you know, New Orleans is the great conservatory of music in North America. I mean, it's the number of talented, accomplished musicians that have come out of there. And your point, again, to go back to something you said earlier, it doesn't fall from the sky. There's a culture. There's a multi-generational commitment by families to do this development. And if we trace that culture back, we're going to find ourselves in Saint-Domingue. And then all of a sudden, it all starts to make sense.
It also makes sense.
Well, great. Well, it's been great to talk. We've been talking with Al Jackson of Treme Petite Jazz Museum. At a minimum, a place you have to visit when you're in New Orleans. But I would consider staying there for at least a few days if you're visiting the city. It's a great part of the city. Governor Nichols is a beautiful street, very well located, and you can walk straight from there to Congo Square, and then right from there into the corridor or into the Marigny and Frenchman, and see some great music. And you'll really have a great introduction to one of the world's great music cities. Well, great, Al. Thank you so much for the time, and I'm looking forward to finally meeting you in person someday. I know it will happen. You were in Cuba when I was in New Orleans.
Yeah.
And so how do you like that? But we're globetrotters here, I guess, but we will be in the same place at the same time someday. I'm looking forward to that.
We're certainly glad. We'd appreciate it. And thanks, Amin, for the interview and that and getting us out there to your listening audience. Really appreciate it.
Igualmente.
Okay. Muchísimas gracias, entonces, señor. Tengo un buen día.